Today's show is sponsored by Pricing Wire. Think about all the time, effort, uncertainty, and everything else you are investing into the software solution you're building. Pricing Wire has helped more than 1,000 software and technology innovators like you take a proactive approach to both discover and get paid what you're truly worth. From early startups to Fortune 500 enterprises, across verticals and around the globe, Pricing Wire delivers easy to understand and actionable recommendations to guide your monetization and pricing strategy. If you want to avoid unnecessary challenges or costly regrets and prevent missing time-sensitive revenue opportunities, Pricing Wire can help. Just go to pricingwire.com and book a strategy session today. Pricing Wire helps technology innovators like you design the right offerings, better quantify and message value, set and change prices, select the right pricing metrics, or even decide if usage-based pricing is best for you. Why wouldn't you want to achieve your revenue goals faster and with more confidence? Learn more at pricingwire.com and start making meaningful progress today.
Cloudcast Media presents from the massive studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. This is The Cloudcast with Aaron Delp and Brian Gracely, bringing you the best of cloud computing from around the world.
Good morning, good evening, wherever you are. Welcome back to The Cloudcast. We are coming to you live from the massive Cloudcast studios here in Raleigh, North Carolina. Getting into the middle of September. Hope you all are doing well. We are starting to hit the fall. Weather's starting to cool off just a little bit, which is nice. Breaking out some fall weather, some fall clothing, and all those good things. This is going to be a little shorter cloud news of the week, both this week and next week. I am going to be traveling quite a bit in Europe for the next 2 weeks. I think about 9 different countries. So for those of you that tune in exclusively for really, really robust cloud news of the week, the next 2 weeks might be a little thin. Apologize for that. But we do have great interviews coming on both shows. This week, just a couple of things of note for Cloud News of the Week. If you had bet early this year on over-under on number of service meshes, if you took the over, you were betting in Las Vegas or in with Betfair or somewhere overseas, you probably would have cashed out pretty well. 2 new service meshes were announced this week, one from Kong, which is called the Kuma service mesh, and another from Containus, C-O-N-T-A-I-N-O-U-S, and it's called Mesh, sort of like mesh, but M-A-E-S-H. Both of them are focused on trying to be a little more simplified from a mesh perspective. One of the knocks on some of the service meshes, in particular Istio, is they can be a little complicated. So if you are thinking to yourself, I have not got enough service mesh in my life, I need to dig into some more, go ahead and take a look at either the Kuma service mesh from Kong or the Mesh from Containus, and we will have links to both those in the show notes. So, with that, that's kind of cloud news of the week. Not a whole lot of other things were announced, and next week we'll see, depending on how much I get to keep up with it, depending on how much I'm traveling, we'll include it. There will be a show next week, so don't worry about that. But the good news is, with last week ending on Friday the 13th and there being a full moon, it is sort of perfectly appropriate that this week's conversation is going to be about chaos engineering. So excited to have a chance to talk about chaos engineering this week. I know we've talked about it in bits and pieces, but we dig into it in a little more detail this week. So it was a fun interview, fun episode. I think you'll enjoy it. And let's go ahead and get to that interview. Today's show is sponsored by DigitalOcean. DigitalOcean offers the simplest, most developer-friendly cloud platform. It's optimized to make managing and scaling apps easy with an intuitive API, multiple storage options, integrated firewalls and load balancers, a new managed Kubernetes service, and much more. From predictable pricing to flexible configurations to world-class customer support, you'll get access to all the infrastructure services you need to grow your business. Plus, DigitalOcean's community provides over 2,000 tutorials to help you stay up to date on the latest open source software, languages, and frameworks. So to get started on DigitalOcean for free, with a free $50 credit, go to do.co/cloudcast. That's do.co/cloudcast. And we're back. You know, folks, one of the topics that a lot of you have given us really positive feedback on and that you're very interested in is obviously kind of this intersection between, the way that we build applications that are, more frequently getting updated. What does that mean from a people and process perspective, whether that's, called SRE or called DevOps? And then, there's this emerging set of technologies around chaos engineering, and we've sort of talked about them a little bit. We've talked about some of the technology aspects of it. We've talked about some of the, the culture aspects at a higher level. But we've never really dove in with, groups of people that are living with this all the time and implementing it and figuring out what does it make sense for their business? Where does it make sense for, the technology? And how do you adapt it to a culture that, may have been used to you know, doing releases once a week, once a month, once a year type of thing. So very, very excited today to have a chance to speak with Paul Osman, who is SRE Engineering Manager at Under Armour. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Brian. Good to be here.
So, you know, as I mentioned in the intro, we're going to talk a little about chaos engineering, which is a topic that you've been, you know, not only talking about and writing about, but living at Under Armour. But before we get into that, I want to talk a little bit about your background. You know, you've worked at a number of places, you've been published on a number of very interesting topics. So give folks a little bit of sense of some of the things that you've been working on, places you've been working on prior to coming to Under Armour, and then we'll dive into some of the things you're doing today.
Yeah, sounds great. I've been working in technology now for coming up on 20 years. Most of my career, I've been in this sort of straddling like back-end services development, back-end engineering, and also the ops space. And so I've been lucky enough to be, working at certain companies that were kind of, early envelope in some of those categories and got to learn a lot and have just been gravitating more and more in that area. So naturally I found myself working, in an SRE team. Before joining Under Armour, I was at PagerDuty. A lot of people will know PagerDuty. I always joke it's like a love-hate relationship. They love that someone wakes them up, but they hate that they're getting woken up.
Right.
But for anybody who doesn't know, PagerDuty is the company that will make sure that the right people get alerted when you have some sort of production incident, and so it allows you to manage on-call schedules and stuff like that. So you can imagine a company like that, availability is like job number one. You know, if the company that tells you you're having an availability outage isn't available, that's not great. So learned a ton there. Before I was at PagerDuty, I was running the platform team at a company called 500 Pixels. And that's a photo sharing website based out of Toronto, Ontario. There I was helping kind of lead the migration from monolith architecture to a microservices architecture. And they were interested in doing that for the reasons that a lot of companies are. They wanted to enable teams to kind of deploy more independently, kind of encourage a more loosely coupled architecture. And actually I, helped introduce them to game days, and we got into some chaos engineering there. Before that, I was at SoundCloud, and I was lucky enough to join SoundCloud right around the time we started doing the migration from a monolithic Rails application to microservices. And that all happened at the same time that SoundCloud was experiencing just explosive growth. So it was like we were evolving the architecture in real time as we were also dealing with, traffic levels we'd never seen before. So it was really exciting to be a part of that.
Yeah, very, very cool. Yeah, we've had PagerDuty and SoundCloud on the show before, and it's very, very cool to kind of get a chance to talk to folks who've dealt with especially the monolith to microservice transition. I think people are very, very interested in that. So and you've written about this, a couple of things. You've got a couple of books that are published, which is fantastic, that we have in the show notes that people can go take a look at.
Yeah, it's certainly an interesting topic. Lots of ways that it can go really right, lots of ways it can go really wrong. So it's something I spent a lot of time talking to a lot of folks about and learning more about myself.
Yeah. So obviously we mentioned chaos engineering in the introduction. You just talked about it a little bit, both in your background and what you're doing today at Under Armour. Before we dive into that too much, on the technical side of things, give us a sense why, to a company like Under Armour, what are some of the business drivers that they say, look, we have these applications out there, we serve consumers, we've got different types of things going on. Like, what helps, what drives them at a business level to say, hey, we need to invest around chaos engineering, we need to understand how to make systems that are, less fragile and so forth. Like, just in the context of the people that speak, dollars and cents and metrics and so forth, like, help people understand what does that mean at a company like Under Armour?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll quickly go over, because not all of your listeners may be familiar, Under Armour has a connected fitness business unit, and that's where I work. And that's where we work on our consumer apps, most notably MyFitnessPal, MapMyFitness, and Endomondo. So our users are, all over the place. They're demographically all over the place, geographically all over the place, and they use our apps to, track some kind of fitness goal. It could be a very specific fitness goal, like, gaining muscle mass, or it could be, or becoming a super, ultra marathon runner, or it could just be like, getting healthier. And to that effect, you know, our users expect our apps to be working. And so they expect a certain resiliency. So when we look at it from, you know, a business perspective, like you mentioned, we're looking at things like, you know, the connection between customer NPS and, you know, revenue. Obviously, if customers are happy using our products, that means that they're more likely to convert. That means that they're more likely to be active, engaged users, which makes them, you know, increases their lifetime value to us. But it also just helps us accomplish our mission, which is, you know, to help people be better, you know, and to hit their goals.
Yeah, very, very cool. Yeah, it's I always like when you break it down to something that simple. It's look, we want happy, satisfied customers, and the business model is built around, you know, when people are happy and satisfied, they have a tendency to, you know, they prefer the brand. When they go make decisions, they do that. And you're ultimately in the business of, while you're selling certain things, you're ultimately going, look, if you are, you know, continue to be motivated to meet your health goals, to meet your fitness goals, to meet your, you know, just kind of happiness goals, you know, other things naturally kind of evolve from that. So it's interesting that you're able to make that high level connection, as opposed to just going, yeah, we need, you know, we need chaos monkeys and simian armies. And it's, you know, it is at a much higher level, which people can relate to.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's actually something I've really appreciated about Under Armour's culture. You know, Under Armour got into this, this world of consumer apps with acquisitions a number of years ago. And the company has been, you know, really intentional about not having like top-down edicts on how we operate as a technology company. And so, you know, there's definitely, you know, shared values, shared business goals, things like that. But when it comes to, you know, protecting uptime, when it comes to, you know, making sure that we're making good decisions to protect our users, you know, that's very kind of bottom up from people who are close to, you know, working close to the iron, so to speak.
Right. So walk us through, because again, one of the things that we try and do on the show or try and highlight, and maybe it doesn't always come out in 30 minutes is, you know, your end customers, your users are expecting, you know, kind of cutting edge technology. To give them those things means you're going to be putting new features into the system or changing things around. That means you've got to have systems that, you know, can evolve over time and so forth. But kind of walk us through, you know, how, you know, we talk about sort of the business needs. Walk through, how does that trickle down to saying, okay, what types of technologies do we have to engage, especially around maybe chaos engineering or, you know, being able to rapidly make changes? And then how does that trickle down to what you've got to do in your culture in terms of saying, hey, we have to be expecting that things are changing all the time. You can't kind of have a static culture or a static. Can you kind of walk people through what that means in your world and how that trickles down to, you know, planning, measuring things and so forth?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a super interesting topic. It's one that different teams, to be honest, at Under Armour at different levels of this. You know, we're certainly on the journey, but we've been shifting over the years from a mentality where, you know, like you're sort of alluding to, where you have like a release schedule where you're gonna, you know, build up a bunch of changes and then release them once a week. So. You know, we've been very intentionally marching towards continuous delivery. And so we've made infrastructure improvements, we've made, you know, investments, we've made tooling investments to make sure that engineers, you know, feel empowered and feel that it's safe to just continuously push out code. So we definitely have some teams who are doing multiple releases a day, like just constant deploys. And that, you know, to your point, brings up, you know, more a different mental model that we sort of try to adapt. That being that, you know, this is a dynamic system and we have to be continuously adapting to the way that the system behaves. So that's been my team's charter since we started. You know, the SRE team, our job primarily is to, you know, build relationships with application engineers who are working on, you know, features, working on reducing technical debt for their teams, and helping them kind of, you know, consider all of the different failure scenarios that can happen. With the inevitable goal of having a system that is resilient to certain types of failures that we experience in production. So, you know, examples of that would be like making sure that our incident response process is really well catered to that. And what I mean there is like we have an incident response process that's fairly well documented internally. We have some tooling that automates some of the steps. But basically, you know, we make sure that the right people are responding so that we can triage and, you know, debug and resolve an incident in as short a time as possible. But then afterwards, we get together and we have, you know, these flameless postmortems to go over the timeline of what happened for an incident. And this is a great opportunity. And it's honestly, I think, something that's, you know, not invested in enough at a lot of companies. It's a great opportunity to sit down with engineering teams and be like, what was surprising? You know, like what happened during this incident where we had some production issue that may have affected customers that we didn't expect? And those are great opportunities to then, you know, come up with ideas for chaos experiments. You know, maybe it was like a database that failed over when we didn't expect it to because we didn't realize that, you know, this certain traffic pattern would put load there. Or maybe it's like timeouts were misconfigured and, you know, we were sending back error codes when we could have been, you know, just ejecting unhealthy nodes from a load balancer or something like that. Whatever it is, the things that, you know, cause people in a postmortem for an incident to go like, oh, wow, that happened. You know, those are always really great opportunities to learn. And then, you know, we can take that learning and even enhance it with chaos engineering by reproducing some of those, you know, conditions in production and making sure that we know exactly how it behaves.
Yeah, no, I think the learning piece of that, you know, having learning be a piece of the culture and, you know, helping people understand the kind of the concept of blameless postmortems, you know, is critical. I think that's, you know, it becomes such an important piece of it. Do you find, so, you know, if I think about whether it's connected health, connected fitness, the apps, you know, like I use one of the apps when I go running and so forth, you know, and there's an aspect of it that's, you know, it's just like, it's a fun user experience. I can track where I go. I could see other people. If I want to, you know, if I go to a new city, I can say, hey, where, you know, where's, you know, popular runs or whatever. But there's also, you know, certain information that, you know, people will give you that, you know, has to be protected fairly well, right? You know, age and information and stuff that somebody might say, oh, well, you know, well, maybe it goes off to insurance or whatever. But anyways, I'm curious, like, there's probably part of the application that, you know, people would look at it and they would say, okay, this is an area where people can get really creative and new things can happen here. And I can see why they'd be experimenting. And then I have to expect there's a part of that application, again, you know, we get into microservices where they say, look, that's kind of like critical data we can't lose. What's the conversation look like across either one application team or multiple teams where you're going, hey, you know, you kind of have different risk profiles or things that you might be willing to change or frequency of change. And you're introducing this idea of things like chaos to them. Like, how do you have that conversation with different people? Do you have to be cognizant of, you know, their willingness to have risk? Or is it one of those things where if you educate them up front about, hey, if we're testing kind of this continuous way, the risk kind of mitigates itself just because we're more aware of what the system, where it'll fail and so forth?
Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely, in my opinion, the latter. You know, it's about educating and building trust. So, you know, on the topic of data privacy, like you mentioned, there's a lot of information that we collect that our users trust us with that we have to be, you know, extremely cautious about, right, in terms of how we handle. And so, you know, we take that very seriously. We have a whole team actually that gets assembled, and that particular aspect is even built into our incident response process. If we suspect that an incident might be related to a data privacy issue, we have a completely different, you know, process that kicks into effect that makes sure it's dealt with the highest priority. But on the preventative side, you know, you mentioned something interesting, which is like getting people adapted to this level of risk tolerance. And, you know, the challenge is actually in educating people that the things that you touch more often are actually almost counterintuitively more reliable. And what I mean by that is, you know, I think we've all probably, you know, worked in companies where, you know, you have this one piece of software or like several pieces of software that everyone's kind of afraid to touch because it's legacy, you know, and it's not deployed very often. And maybe you have someone who, you know, is on staff and she's the only one who really truly understands it. Those systems are actually the more brittle. And they're more brittle because, you know, people know the less about them. They're less capable of responding when things go wrong with them. And they're the things that typically would, you know, you would never think about approaching with something like chaos engineering, because they also tend to be, you know, because they've aged in such that way, they're more, you know, tightly coupled, they're a little bit more brittle, et cetera. And so, you know, we really try to popularize internally the idea that moving faster is actually a way to increase our, you know, resiliency. And so we've been experimenting with certain metrics that we measure across the board. And you know, one set of metrics that we've started to look at very seriously is what's commonly referred to as the four key metrics. This was popularized in the book Accelerate by Nicole Forsgren and Jez Humbel and Gene Kim. They're the folks who do the really good work behind the State of DevOps report. The four key metrics are basically, you know, mean time to resolve, deployment frequency, change fail percentage, and I knew I was going to forget one off the bat. Let's see, MTTR, change fail percentage, deployment frequency, and
That's okay. Folks are pretty familiar with Gene and Nicole's book, and also we'll just refer them back to that. I think they've all got it on their bookshelf. It's okay.
Yeah, perfect. So yeah, we've been experimenting with that, and one of the reasons that we're pushing those metrics is the idea that, you know, when you increase your deploy frequency, you can also decrease your MTTR, for instance. And those are two things that people might not, you know, immediately correlate, but it nevertheless are true. So to your question, like those areas where you have, you know, more sort of sensitivity to risk, those are areas that you actually want to be testing more frequently.
Right. Absolutely. You know, I think sometimes when, especially people that have been in, say, infrastructure for a while, they'll hear about chaos, they're trying to learn about it, and they kind of think about it. Sometimes I'll hear they'll think about it like it's a DR event. Well, it's something we should do once every quarter or once every 6 months or something. And I think in reality, it's something that you have to make, you know, kind of a regular activity, right? It's like any physical activity. You know, if you let your muscles atrophy, it doesn't happen. Can you give us a sense of kind of how your team thinks about it in terms of the frequency, or, you know, how often you do it, or just, you know, kind of how do you think about chaos in a, you know, working environment, in a production environment? Is it scheduled? Do you do it periodically on purpose, or, and then how do you measure it, you know, once it's in place?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, again, we're kind of all over the map there. There's a sort of, gradient, you know. Some teams do periodic game days, and, you know, that's where we actually do schedule the activity, and we sort of let a team know, and my team often are driving this, in fact, and we let the team know that, hey, you know, we'd like to get together and, you know, come up with some scenarios that we want to test in production on this service. And that's, you know, oftentimes like that will actually spawn some really good discussions, and, you know, a lot of the value is in the sort of design of the game day. Like, what kind of failure, you know, scenarios do we want to force for this service to see how it behaves? Other teams we're you know, starting to experiment with doing more lightweight experiments. And what I mean by that is, like, even in design time, as you're, you know, developing something and you're pushing it out into production, but it's not necessarily receiving, you know, traffic, maybe it's behind a rollout or something like that, you know, we'll encourage people to, like, you know, just use tooling to test what happens when you increase latency between that service and a data store or an upstream service, or what happens when it can't talk to, you know, some critical upstream service or something like that. So that's something that we're definitely, you know, interested in continuing, is like making this investment in, like, small, lightweight, you know, experiments, so you don't have to take a whole day. But we definitely still get a lot of value out of those game days. And we make sure that we do them with a fairly regular cadence. In terms of measuring, you know, I'll refer back to the four key metrics. And I just remembered it was lead time to production is the one I forgot to mention. But the four key metrics, you know, if we're standardizing on that as a way of measuring, you know, how well, you know, we're performing, then we have to draw a thesis that, like, teams that do chaos engineering might perform better in some of these areas. And so one obvious example is, like, if you're doing chaos engineering and you're doing it well, in my opinion, that should also increase the team's comfort level with their services, with the services that they own. And that means that they're, you know, more well-versed in terms of what metrics they collect, what metrics are valuable to collect. They're collecting data on, like, you know, what should we be measuring that we're not currently. And this will help a team improve when, you know, a production incident does happen that's unexpected. They, you know, will naturally be able to get in there and triage things much more quickly because they've run through a number of scenarios already. So that's one way that we can sort of measure this stuff. But it's sort of like, you know, unit testing, or it's sort of like, you know, load testing. Like, we don't measure at that granular level and say like, hey, this is proving to be effective or not. We sort of zoom out, look at like, you know, we're doing X, Y, and Z. Is there a positive correlation with the metrics that our customers really care about?
Right. Right. Yeah. And it's like everything in measurement, you could measure everything, but there's always a cost and a time element to it. And at some point you figure out which ones are useful to us and which ones are just, you know, more noise to signal kind of thing.
That's exactly it. And, you know, I mean, if there's not a good story behind what you're measuring, then, you know, it's subject to being misconstrued. It's all sorts of things. So for us, we just try to zoom out and look at overall performance.
Right. Right. You know, one of the things I think people, they ask questions about, they struggle with a little bit is, you know, we talked about blameless postmortems, and we've talked about, you know, introducing, you know, chaos as a regular thing. You talked about educating. What have you found is maybe the most difficult part of getting people to understand that that's the culture, that's accepted part of the culture, especially if they've come from a place where, you know, maybe they're afraid to fail. They've seen people get fired for something breaking, or, you know, what have you found has been a useful part of the education or things that you bring into the culture so that people feel confident that, you know, not that they should break things on purpose, but that's an accepted thing, that the systems are in place to deal with that. Any tips on what you found in terms of helping teams grow to feel comfortable with it and make that, you know, an acceptable part of the culture?
Yeah, that's a great topic. This is one of those cultural things that I think is critical, is building that trust into an organization where, you know, people just see, I even hesitate to use the word failure. They see that things will happen. You know, there's that great quote, like, things that have never happened happen all the time. You know, like, understanding that, I think, is really, really good. The things that we've done, and I've seen work at other companies too, to try to promote that, there's a few. First is like, just, you know, lead by example. So postmortems are another great venue for this. You know, when we get together for a postmortem, oftentimes, you know, I'll try to include certain people who are really good at making themselves vulnerable in a discussion. And what I mean by that is kind of being like, if you have a senior technical person who's, you know, looked up to and has a good, you know, reputation throughout the organization, if they're in a postmortem and they're one of the first people to be like, you know, when this happened, I could not tell for the life of me what was happening, you know, or, hey, when, you know, I was doing this, I wasn't really confident, and, you know, maybe this is why. Like, if they're willing to start talking about that, other people just naturally open up. And it's kind of an amazing thing when it goes really well, and especially I've had examples where I've been in postmortems with fairly new employees to the organization. And, you know, you see them start to, like, their eyes kind of light up and they're like, oh, we can talk about this. Oh, I can talk about how I was feeling during this incident. And it's a great thing to witness. So that's one thing. But one thing that we honestly, you know, is still something that we struggle with, and I've talked to plenty of organizations who share this, and it's just something that we're trying to put more and more focus on, is getting people, you know, to actually see value before they attend one of these things. So, you know, if we put out a call to, like, hey, we're going to have a postmortem and it's going to be open to everyone, we want as many people as possible to be joining in that, because it's an opportunity to learn. And definitely we see examples where we're still getting over the hump in some teams where, you know, they will naturally see it as a kind of a chore, like, oh, I have to go to this postmortem. And you can see in the body language, you know, you can see arms crossed, or you can see people, you know, sort of hesitant to give much information. But that's something that I've noticed does get better the more you do it. So we're just continuing to do it and continuing to try to make this as a positive experience as possible. Because if you want people, like, you know, walking away with like, oh, that was so interesting, I learned a ton about, you know, the system I didn't know that much about, or something like that. The other thing we've been trying to do lately, we have yet to do this one, but we've been talking about it internally, myself and a few other people, and I really like the idea, so I'm excited to see how it goes. But just having a sort of informal meetup within the company every 2 weeks or so, making it super casual, optional for everyone, but we're calling it TIL. And it's basically going to be a forum where, you know, it's almost like demos, except people go around and talk about something that totally surprised them or something they didn't realize about the system that they worked on. And so it can be like something that, you know, something neat you learned about ExtraDB, MySQL clusters, or, you know, something about a particular system we operate. But the idea, again, is to encourage, you know, people to be forward with the stuff that they don't know, because, you know, that shows a growth mentality and it helps everybody else in the org grow.
Got it. Got it. Very, very cool. Yeah, no, it's, you know, I always find every little tip that we can kind of expose through the show and from people that are living with it, it's useful. People kind of, it's easier to get smaller tips like that than have to go, oh, we have to do this massive thing. And again, I think once you start to build on building a culture that allows more flexibility, allows failure to be part of what's acceptable, you know, like you mentioned, it sort of builds upon itself. And, you know, people feel like learning and sharing becomes something that's you know, accepted, encouraged, as opposed to discouraged and kind of beaten up on.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Paul, listen, we really appreciate it. We thank you very much for the time today, kind of sharing your knowledge. Folks, Paul is going to be presenting at Velocity over in Europe, but you know, the videos are always posted. All of the links to his books and so forth will be in the show notes. So, Paul, thank you so much for the time today. We really, really appreciate it. Folks, as we wrap it up today, I want to thank both DigitalOcean and PricingWire for sponsoring today's show. It's easy to learn more about PricingWire and book a strategy session at pricingwire.com. So with that, we're going to wrap it up. We want to thank everybody for listening every week. We want to thank everybody for telling a friend, for rating the show and sharing it on iTunes and all the other places. And with that, we're going to wrap it up and we will talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to The Cloudcast. Please visit thecloudcast.net to find more shows, show notes, videos, and everything social media.